Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwartzdropper. On today's show, we're talking about the FCC and economics. Is the FCC an economics-free zone, as a former economist, a Democrat, Tim Brennan, recently lamented about the FCC's work on net neutrality? Others have criticized the agency for not engaging in enough economic analysis when making major decisions that impact the economy. Joining me to discuss this is Hal Singer, a senior fellow at the GW Institute for Public Policy. That's GWIP, or GWIP for short. Hal, thanks for joining the show.
Thanks for having me here, Evan.
And Hal recently joined us for a net neutrality event at GW, where we had a nice debate over the future of the issue. So we'll be sure to link to that in the show notes, and be sure to check out that video. It's pretty lively. So Hal, you know, this is a hell of an accusation to make about an agency that has a Bureau of Economics, that has economists working in it, and that points to economic analysis in its rulemakings. So how dare you accuse the honorable FCC of being free of economics? Where do you draw this accusation from?
Well, you know, first, thanks for having me on again. The quote "econ free," which is great because it fits conveniently in a hashtag, came from the former chief economist Tim Brennan of the FCC, who oversaw economic policy when the FCC was implementing its open internet order. So that's the genesis of the idea. But you know, if you start to dig into it, a lot of things point in the same direction. For example, what we found is that the FCC has basically stopped doing economic analysis. Now, what's important to point out is this should not be interpreted in any way as a dig on the economists who are there. In fact, in the paper, we say that they likely have the best economists in this area. It's just that those economists don't have any influence of the FCC. A few points. Number one is that, you know, they conducted just four economic seminars in 2015, and we went back and looked at what the average was over, you know, a five-year period before, and they were conducting something on the order of 16. So clearly economic activity is being wound down there. As another example, you know, in 1980, they formed an in-house economic think tank, the Office of Plans and Policy, and it was putting out multiple white papers a year that were guiding the FCC in its decision making, and those white papers mysteriously came to a halt in 2012, and they've been replaced by these silly fact sheets that are completely devoid, you know, of any economic analysis or facts for that matter.
So it's worth noting, you know, clearly there's going to be a shift from administration to administration, and it's, you know, no surprise that in the 1980s, when Ronald Reagan was president, that something like an economic think tank would be formed, because we were, you know, studying supply side economics and trying to deregulate the economy. But it lasted all the way until 2012. So Bill Clinton didn't get rid of it. George Bush kept it, and Obama kept it until very recently. And the lack of economic analysis over the past year, 2015, also coincides with several major economic initiatives: net neutrality, set-top boxes, broadband privacy, special access, you know, prison phone calls. I mean, they've been very productive in many ways if you're a fan of the FCC. So is it bizarre that at the same time that they're doing more work, they're doing less economics?
Yeah, the point that I think I want to take away and stress is that there is no correlation between Republican and economics. In fact, if you were to poll most economists, at least academic economists, they tend to tilt towards the Democratic Party.
Is that consistent across academia in general, or?
The Wall Street Journal recently did a poll of economists to see which way they were leaning in terms of Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, and the vast majority leaned towards Hillary Clinton. So it is amazing to me that economics would be drawn down at the FCC at this time. And in fact, you know, as you pointed out, in the 1990s, during Bill Clinton's presidency, we really had the peak influence of economics. What we saw was economists were the designers. Folks like Evan Quirrell at the FCC were the designers of the spectrum auctions. This really was the pinnacle of economic influence of the FCC. We knew we had to allocate spectrum in a different way, in an intelligent way. And we knew the only people really fit to design that new allocation were economists.
So I want to get to a couple of things, like how the FCC has changed and what some of these recent rulemakings have to say about economics. But first, let's just paint a picture for the listeners what we mean by economic analysis. I mean, in my mind, I'm thinking cost benefit. I'm thinking the FCC wants to put out net neutrality rules because it has certain values it wants to uphold, like no blocking, no throttling, no discrimination, no paid prioritization, right? These are values. These are policy preferences. And what a cost-benefit analysis would have done in theory would be to say, okay, we have these values. We want to implement them. Will these on the whole benefit consumers and the economy and businesses and everyone in the ecosystem, or will they be detrimental? And that is an important question to ask. Is your assertion that the FCC basically makes up its mind before any analysis is done and then tailors the economic analysis to the outcome that it wants?
Yes, you're being a little too generous. They didn't even tailor any economics. There were no economics in the order that ultimately approved this open internet provisions. You're exactly right about what economics brings to the party. It's that it's a rigorous study of the costs and benefits of a proposal. And this is key. You know, one thing that we forget about often is, well, if a proposal generates more benefits than costs, and let's do it. No. Actually, what cost-benefit analysis tells you is that if there exists, and this is key, a less restrictive alternative that generates more benefits on net, right, then your proposal fails. And this concept is completely foreign to the folks who are running the FCC right now. Judge Williams, in his dissent,
Is the dissent in the litigation where the telecoms and groups like Tech Freedom intervened to try to stop the FCC's open internet order from taking effect.
Correct. And Judge Williams, in his dissent, vindicated the economists who were relegated to the sidelines by pointing out that the order ignored the advice of three former FCC chief economists. And what's important here is that the economists weren't saying, no problem, don't intervene. Instead, what they were saying was, consider a less restrictive alternative. Consider the possibility of using case-by-case review of complaints as they arise in connection to these paid priority arrangements, and make the call at the time as to whether that particular arrangement is pro or anti-competitive, or reasonable or unreasonable.
So that's a very important distinction. It is not just that any proposal should be studied, and then if the benefits outweigh the cost, then that's the best option. Part of CBA, cost-benefit analysis for short, is that you consider a range of options, and that just because one proposal might be beneficial to consumers on net doesn't mean one wouldn't be more beneficial. So it is not just, I make up my mind, and then if it passes CBA, it's good to go. It's, did you consider other options? Was there a less restrictive way of doing this? And that's required by law, right? I mean,
well, not of independent agencies. So the FCC even said, when it put out the open internet order, it released a two-pager that was supplemental to something in the Congressional Budget Act and said, quote, I'm paraphrasing, we have no obligation to perform cost-benefit analysis. And when you go into the order itself and you look to see how they treated this less restrictive alternative, they dismissed it in a paragraph. And the phrase that they used was, it was too, quote, cumbersome. Unquote. It's too cumbersome, and therefore we're giving up on it. No citation as to why it was cumbersome, you know, what it would mean to actually go forward with a case by case. It was just too cumbersome, you know, but a lot of things in life are too cumbersome. I go for jogs, you know, sometimes brushing your teeth or flossing is cumbersome,
oh,
right?
Oh, man. And it's not even clear that flossing is beneficial anymore, right?
Yeah, but we do it anyway.
I'm still going to do it. I mean, why take the chance, right? But so maybe it's because the Republicans keep cutting their funding, right? I mean, if the Republicans would just fully fund the FCC, then they would, of course, engage in more economic analysis.
No, I don't think so. I don't think that this is from any lack of funding of economic analysis. The economists are there. You know, when I go in and
are you sure, though? Because we were joking about this before the show. I mean, you asserted that the economists at the FCC are not the problem. They have expertise. Maybe they're not being utilized properly. Has anyone actually gone to the FCC to confirm that these people are there and they haven't been sent to Australia or to Siberia or somewhere where they can be kept away from the political machine at the FCC? Because we wouldn't want to mix economics and politics, right?
I think they've been locked away on a floor. It might be the seventh, and you hear, if you go up to the buildings, to the back of the building, listen closely, you can hear little screams coming out. Please. I'm trying to get the hashtag unlock the economist going. You know, the FCC and its fans have been so successful at the hashtag unlock the box.
Yeah, and there's this is just to allude to other work that Tech Freedom has done on the Federal Trade Commission. This is a similar critique that my boss Barron has had about the FTC, that they have really, really talented economists on staff, and they are basically wasted because the focus is on enforcement at the FTC and the focus is on regulation at the FCC.
Right. And so one of the things that we investigate in the paper is why do you relegate the economist, you know, to the back closet? Why is it important? And what we figured out is that economics is really standing in the way of what they want to achieve politically. We think that they're kind of lost in terms of a mission. We think that the current congressional mandate that they have speaks to a product, namely voice service, that is largely going away. And so there's this vacuum that they're now taking advantage of by just basically throwing themselves into the populist winds.
And when you say vacuum, it's important to point out that there was an actual vacuum. When the FCC passed its open internet order, it reclassified broadband providers as common carriers, which by law stripped jurisdiction from the Federal Trade Commission and gave it to the FCC, which made the FCC the premier regulator of internet infrastructure in the country when before it was not necessarily. So he's not just, you know, listeners, he's not just saying a vacuum. He literally means a regulatory vacuum.
Well, one of the things that we're seeking when we'll talk about this, I hope, later is in terms of the policies that we're actually recommending. We think that Congress could assist here by clarifying what exactly the FCC should be doing and what its mandate is with respect to broadband and internet services.
A mandate that has not been updated since 1996. And before that, there hadn't been a major overhaul since 1934. And that brings me to history, right? Because it's important to look at the FCC over time and see if there is actually anything remarkable about the current chairman, Tom Wheeler, and the FCC under the Obama administration, or if history is just repeating itself. And is it fair to say that between, you know, the 1920s and, I mean, the FCC is as old as 1934, but, you know, 1920s to 1950s or so, it was also an economics-free zone at the FCC. I mean, I had Brent Skorup from Mercatus on the show talking about how spectrum licenses used to be given out for things like radio. And it was a beauty contest. People would show up and it was like a damn sales meeting. It had nothing to do with economics. People would just be like, oh, I deserve the spectrum because I'm going to put educational programming on, or I'm going to put this amount of children programming. It wasn't like you see today, where you've got T-Mobile and Verizon and AT&T going at it and bidding on the spectrum. So we've seen other FCCs be economics free. I mean, is this particularly bad today?
So you're right that from in that early period, there was a lack of economics. There was this important concept, and it's coming back again. It was called zero price spectrum. And the notion was that spectrum is so precious.
The airwaves, right,
is so precious that it would be unethical almost to put a price on it. You know, that would allow the big players to come in and buy it up.
It's kind of the argument you hear about not being able to sell your organs, or like there are certain things that are so sacred, like public education, that you cannot introduce the profit motive into the equation.
Correct. They defy economics, right?
Right.
And so this concept was very popular at the FCC. And in fact, we tell a story, and we weren't the first to tell it. It's been told many times. But about a future Nobel Prize winner, Ronald Coase, going into the FCC and presenting a paper in the late 50s and literally being mocked by a commissioner. The commissioner, you know, said, what are you spoofing us? Is this a big joke? And it would be so wonderful to have kind of sat there and observed this, but you can only kind of think about what it must have been like for Coase to walk out of the room and say these ideas have just been, you know, laughed literally out of the room. But yeah. Lo and behold, you know, 40 years later, we had a spectrum auction.
Yeah, we look back on Ronald Coase as a visionary, but it's amazing how someone who is mocked in their present day can then be considered a hero later on. And maybe we'll see a similar dynamic where the FCC has laughed off all sorts of concerns about its rulemakings and its process and anything. And it might take a couple decades to see just how damaging those things were.
And I want to pick up just real quick on this zero price point, you know, that some things are just too precious for prices. If you think about it, we have a zero price rule for priority now, right? The notion is that you could give priority. You as an ISP, you can treat certain packets differently than others. You just can't put a price on it. So this notion of zero price, which kind of lingered from the 20s to the late 50s, has now reemerged in that priority is too precious right, to put a price on it. The notion is that if we allow, say, Comcast or Verizon to charge, then they're going to do evil things. Just prices in and of themselves are evil. So prices are gone.
And we're seeing that argument be made by our friends on the left when it comes to data allowances. So what's really funny is you'll see a real contradiction when it comes to zero rating, which is another form of zero pricing. T-Mobile's Binge On. You can watch as much video as you want. Doesn't count against your data. Facebook's got programs in the developing world where people can sign up for, you know, 100 or so basic websites for free, and then maybe they'll sign up for the full internet. And these are initiatives aimed at benefiting consumers. But our friends over at Free Press and Public Knowledge, they complain about this stuff. And it's funny because they'll say, well, no, T-Mobile should not be able to make Netflix zero data. But they also shouldn't be able to only give consumers 4 gigabytes of data. So really the left is saying everyone should be able to use as much data as they want all the time, no throttling, highest speed ever imaginable, and they should all pay the same regardless of how much they use. I mean, we're seriously getting into the idea that the internet is too sacred for prices and that we shouldn't have to pay for it.
And
that my grandmother, who uses email, which is extremely low bandwidth, should have to subsidize the guy who's got 4 Netflix streams going on all day. I mean, we're really getting into a situation where it's basically socialism. There's no price differentiation. People don't pay for what they use. There's no personal responsibility. We're all just a bunch of dumb pipes, and the traffic will flow through, and there is no one's allowed to make money. I mean, what are these ridiculous, how does this happen?
The zero price concept is everywhere. I mean, if I can talk about the set-top box proposal, which is now kind of heating up.
Yeah, and this is the FCC's proposal to force companies, MVPDs, we call them, telephone companies, satellite companies, and cable companies that provide cable in the traditional sense, to force them to unbundle their video stream and give that out to any third party that wants to sell a box or an app to a customer.
And the notion here that's driving the proponents bazonkers is the notion that there is a positive price to the rental of the box. They want to see that price go down to zero, right? And this is the story I like to tell. I have a neighbor, and I hope he's not listening to the podcast, but
I doubt it.
He's got a TV. He's got a TV in a box in every room, and he has multiple in some rooms. He even has a TV and a box in his kitchen. This guy, he's not poor, and he's signaling to Verizon, which is his provider, that he's got a huge willingness to pay, right, for this service. And what Verizon is doing is they're effectively charging him a lot more for the same service that he has, so that he can have a TV on basically every time he walks into a new room of his house. Then they charge me.
Yeah. Right? Well, what's funny about that is that he could have bought one box, signed up for the account, and then put a cheap third-party device like a Roku or a Chromecast in all the other rooms and used the MVPD's app. So even without the FCC's regulations, there are ways to get around things that you find annoying about the marketplace. But God forbid consumers have to do anything out of the norm to react and adapt to a situation.
My point is that he's revealing with his 10, 15 boxes in his house that he has a really high value, right, for these services. And to an economist, there's nothing wrong with the notion that Verizon ends up charging him more per month than they charge me. There's nothing wrong with it. It's called metering. The idea is that this will allow the operator to rebalance its prices in such a way as to keep rates for basic cable service low. And that hopefully will bring more people onto the network.
So you've talked a little bit about how Congress can fix this. What would that look like?
Yeah, so I think first that they need to clarify, for a lot of us, we think it's clear enough. They say something in the preamble in the current act. They say something to the effect that internet ought to be subject to very light or light touch or unregulated. Apparently, this wasn't strong enough.
That was in the 1996 Act.
In the 1996 Act. So we do think that there could be clarifying language that tells the FCC precisely how internet service, both fixed and mobile, ought to be regulated. And ideally, they would give the FCC some authority to do so outside of Title II.
Yeah, and then there's also efforts to rein in regulation in general that would include the FCC. You've got SOPRA, the Separation of Powers Restoration Act, and that would end effectively the practice of Chevron deference, whereby courts, anytime there's ambiguity in law, courts just accept the regulator's interpretation, even when it could be as impactful as Title II. So that probably needs to get fixed. There's a couple other bills like the REINS Act, R-E-I-N-S, about reining in regulation. So whether it's a targeted strike, like you've suggested, specifically at the FCC, or whether it's a general reform of the regulatory apparatus, unless Congress steps in, this is going to be a case-by-case adjudication in the courts of everything the FCC does, and it will provide very little certainty for business.
Well, I want to make something very concrete in terms of my proposal. In addition to taking Title II off the table, right? What I'm advocating is that Congress ought to be explicit in giving the FCC authority to regulate ISPs with respect to things like paid priority and blocking and the like, but subject to a different source of authority. And I actually think it would be helpful if the FCC were directed to go forward precisely as they tried to go in the 2010 open internet order. But as we know what happened there, they tried to ground it in 706 and we got caught up in this presumption. I think that if Congress gave the FCC explicit authority to do precisely what they wanted to do in the 2010 open internet order, we'd get to a happy place.
Yeah, and that's what you're describing as a compromise, because there are some Democrats who support net neutrality legislation because they think it will be more lasting than a constant back and forth with president to president and court battles. There are Republicans who are willing to compromise on this issue. They're not being ideologues. There are a lot of Republicans who don't like the bill you're describing because it is a compromise. So the point is that there are people, and you could count me among them, who think this whole concern over net neutrality is hypothetical nonsense. Yet if the FCC really feels the need to regulate, they should do so with authority from Congress. And that is a compromise that I can accept, because it is a hell of a lot better than the regulator just roping it into Title II, 1934 monopoly era telephone regulation, without discussing anything with Republicans or trying to find any common ground. And there's no reason to think that a Trump FCC or any other Republican FCC won't just swing the pendulum back the other way and will just go back and forth, president to president, with absolutely no certainty.
To highlight the fact that it's a compromise, I should tell you that my co-author, Jerry Fallhaber, who was, of course, a former chief economist of the FCC, doesn't love the compromise that we end up peddling in the paper. He actually thinks that the 2010 order, by setting the presumption against any paid priority, that is, any paid priority would be presumptively in violation, you recall, and the court got choked up over that. They thought it was tantamount to common carriage. You know, he thinks that as an economist, and if economists were to write it, the presumption would be flipped around. That is, you'd be allowed to do paid priority, and the burden would be on some intervening party to show that it was not reasonable.
Yeah, the basic idea is innocent until proven guilty, rather than guilty until proven innocent. We're not talking about criminals, we're talking about business models.
But what Chairman Jenikowski figured out, and I think it was very, very very sharp, was that it was a setting the presumption against the ISPs, but allowing these transactions, that is, refraining from blanket ban, was a political compromise. It was a very smart political compromise. And as an economist, I think we ought to be willing to live with that.
Well, we'll see what happens. I mean, there are a few things that might spur more legislative talk. If somehow, it's unlikely, but if the open internet order were to go down anytime soon, whether on rehearing or by the Supreme Court, that might bring Democrats to the table, a change in Congress, a change in administration, more vocal opposition from Democrats about the new set-top box bills. I mean, a million things could happen, but right now there doesn't seem to be much of an appetite for reform. But we'll keep looking out. I mean, this is a live issue. You've got your paper out, The Curious Absence of Economic Analysis at the FCC, an agency in search of a mission, that is co-written by my guest Hal Singer and his colleague Jerry Fallhaber, a former FCC economist. And you also have an op-ed in The Hill that we linked to in the show notes for today. Any last words before we wrap up?
The last thing I want to say, we asked for one other thing from Congress, and this is a big one. It goes beyond just fixing what happened in the net neutrality proceeding. We would like the FCC to be subject to a cost-benefit requirement in any future rulemaking proceeding. I'll make a bold prediction here. When you look at the set-top box order, when you look at the privacy order, when you look at the business data services order, look for dissenting economic views I'm sending you on a goose chase. And look for the way that the FCC handles those dissenting views. My fear is that they're going to treat them the same way that, they treated the dissents from the former chief economist who weighed in the open internet. That is, they'll just silence them. They'll be disappeared. There won't be any discussion of them. And that's what terrifies me. I want to see the FCC be forced to defend its positions in a rigorous way.
Well, if you're an FCC economist locked on the seventh floor in a dungeon or in Siberia, wherever you are, I got a couple pieces of advice. Scream louder. Eventually, someone will hear you and save you. If you somehow have an internet connection, tweet me. I can call the police on your behalf, although they may be in on this conspiracy as well. And otherwise, look for, sharp objects to cut the handcuffs. I'm not a Houdini. I'm not sure how these poor economists are going to get out of this jam, but if you're listening to this, I really wish you the best. My guest has been Hal Singer, a senior fellow at the GW Institute for Public Policy. I mentioned the paper and op-ed he's got out. Check those out. Hal, thanks for joining the show.
Thanks for having me.
Follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Let us know what you think of the show. Send a get well card to the jailed economists. Send us an email at media@techfreedom.org. Find this podcast in the iTunes store or on your favorite app, where you can leave a review because it will help others find the show. And I'll be looking out for some help messages in the iTunes store. Thanks for listening.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.